You're listening to the School Success Formula with me, Lucy Parsons. This is episode number 15. Welcome to the show today. I'm so glad you're here and you're listening. This show, I think it really is very, very interesting. I'm interviewing Joanna Grace, who is an expert in senses and how using the senses can help students with special educational needs to learn. But what we talked about in this discussion is how we can reinterpret her experience of teaching children with special educational needs to actually help children in mainstream education through fully using the senses. And we cover fascinating things in this discussion, like how forgetting words and how to stop it happening in an exam, why smell is one of the most powerful senses to use to prompt your memory so you can help your child to use it in revision, and how to create a calming and nurturing environment that promotes learning. My favourite quote from Jo during this show is, "A stressed brain can't learn." And I think that's so important for us as parents to remember, because one of our primary duties as parents is to create that calm and supportive environment to help our child to learn. And I know it's challenging and difficult at times, but that's what we should be aiming for all the time. Okay, I'll stop introducing and we'll go straight over to the interview. Enjoy. Our guest today is an international sensory engagement and inclusion specialist, trainer, author, and founder of the Sensory Project. Consistently rated as outstanding by Ofsted, she taught in mainstream and special school settings, connecting with pupils of all ages and abilities before setting up the Sensory Project. Her work is heavily informed by research as well as by insight gleaned from her own private and professional experience. Her private life includes family members with profound disabilities and time spent as a registered foster carer for children with profound disabilities. In addition to her teaching, she has also worked as an inspector of schools and a writer of educational materials. Her book, Sensory Stories for Children and Teens, sells globally, and she has a further 6 books due for publication within the next 2 years, including 4 children's books. Sensory Being for Sensory Beings is the next practitioner book due for publication by Routledge on the 6th of September 2017. Welcome to the School Success Formula, Joanna Grace.
Hello, Lucy. Thank you so much for that introduction, and hello, everybody who's listening.
Well, it's wonderful to have you here. I'm fascinated by your story and all the little bits and pieces that you've got in there. So I'd love you to tell us a bit more about how you got involved in special needs education and what fires you up about that particular sector.
People with special educational needs and disabilities have always been a part of my life. My mother used to work for the Family Fund and the Independent Living Fund, and my grandfather was a paraplegic. And so they've just always been a normal part of my life, and not particularly remarkable to me in that regard. And I'd love to say I had a better route in than this, but essentially I went to university. I studied philosophy because I love the subject. I got back from university and had a summer job working as a teaching assistant, supporting children with special needs in a mainstream setting, purely just because I needed a job. And my mother told me I had a degree and I had to do something with it. And I trained to be a teacher very much against my will. And you get to the point in the course where they're saying, now's the time to apply for jobs.
Were you a secondary or primary specialist?
I was trained as a primary school teacher. Mm-hmm. And applying for a teaching job, as most of your listeners will know, is a bit like sitting an exam. It takes 2 hours to fill in the form. Mm-hmm. And I was sending off for these forms and thinking, I don't want to spend 2 hours of my life lying to you about why I want this job. And so I didn't apply for any positions, and then a job at a special school came up, and I thought, oh, that would be interesting, that would be worth doing. And I applied for that job and the school employed me, and it's all run on from there, really.
It's amazing, isn't it, how life can give you these little signals and signposts to what you really should be doing.
It's I was asked recently to write a blog post for my old university. I studied philosophy, and when you're a philosophy student, people always say, what use will that be to you? What's the point in doing that? And actually, those things that I studied, I use every day at the sensory projects. Those questions about what makes life worth living, what is meaning, all those sort of conceptual, philosophical things really, really come into play when you're working with people with very profound disabilities. And also, you know, aside from my career, my childhood, my hobbies, all the stuff that I love doing is making things out of cardboard boxes and painting pictures. And in teaching children with profound special needs, you have to be creative.
Yeah.
And so that creativity combined with the sort of philosophical interest just turns out this is the job that matches. And I'm delighted to have discovered it by accident.
I'm absolutely fascinated there. It's a bit of an aside to the subject of this podcast, but so many students and parents come to me kind of wanting to do a more vocational subject. They say, oh, I want to do medicine or law. I want to study business. You know, it's something that they can see that there's a real purpose for and there's a career path through. And I'm always saying that's not the point of a university education. A university education is about expanding your mind and teaching you to think. And actually, once you've learnt those skills, you can go on and do whatever you want in the workplace, and you can adapt almost to any kind of setting that takes your interest. And it sounds very much like that's what's happened with you, that philosophy yeah. has kind of led you to this place where you need to answer these deep questions, and the philosophy has given you the toolkit really to do that.
I think it would have been a much harder decision to make in a time without grants. I was the last year through on grants. But in my choice of my A-levels and in my choice of my degree, I chose the subjects that I loved. And I didn't know what they would qualify me to do, but I figured they would qualify me to do something that I loved. And it has taken me until my 30s to get to be in a position where my work is absolutely what I love every day. And if you were to put me on holiday, I would want to be back at work because I love this job so much. But it's not a straightforward route there. It's a good 10 years of bumping into jobs that you don't match up against.
Yeah. And
but it's fascinating.
Yeah, I think that's often the case, that whatever you go into as a career, that you kind of get this, you know, it's not straightforward. Like, what I've got a niece who's trained to be a doctor, and she's in her early 30s and she's still not quite qualified. She will qualify this year. Yeah. And, you know, that's a long old route to actually qualifying to be a doctor. And I don't think a lot of teenagers, when they're thinking about this career path, realise that it's only almost whatever you choose to do, it's only really in your 30s that your career starts to flower. And it's almost like this... it's like following your passion gets you to the point where you really, really want to be in the end. Anyway, that's an aside. Let's get back to talking about senses and learning. So it's great to hear about that kind of combination of the kind of crafty, creative side of your passions and how that combines into what you do now. So can you tell us a bit more about the kind of sensory aspect of that and why that is so important for learning, and not just for children with special needs, but for all children?
Yes. So the sensory projects runs on the idea that you don't need expensive resources to have effective tools for including people in a sensory way. And for some of the individuals that I work with, a sensory curriculum, sensory learning is their only way of learning, as they're not able to access language and things like that. And so when I look at how we support somebody with those such high levels of need in accessing learning, in remembering things, in exploring new topics, if something supports people who face so many barriers to their learning, then of course it also supports people who don't face those barriers. I think with a lot of SEN provision, if you look at those children in your classroom who've got special needs and disabilities and you think, oh, I've got to do something different for that child, and if only that child wasn't there, I could teach all these other children so much more effectively. you set yourself up to feel a resistance against inclusion. If you recognise that that child is the tip of an iceberg and it's that child that you need to do that stuff for, but actually when you do that stuff in your teaching, you also support all those hidden children underneath, you know, the base of that iceberg. These things that benefit people with special needs and disabilities also benefit everybody else. And the sensory stuff is just one of those examples. So to give you a sensory example, when you learn a subject, if you learn it and use different senses when you're learning it, more of your brain is involved in the learning process, just quite literally. If we were to look into your brain and watch what was going on, different areas of it would be lighting up. And if more of your brain is involved in your learning, then more of your brain can be a part of understanding what's going on, and more of your brain will be available to you to remember what's going on. And for my students, or for the students that I typically work with, this might look like a wonderful multi-sensory exploration where we've got things to touch and smell and all of that. Mm-hmm. But for more able students, it could just mean that when you revise a particular topic, you revise with a certain colour pen and a certain colour highlighter, and you always stick to those colours for that topic. Mm-hmm. And maybe you associate another sensory system with it as well. So you could use a scented pen, and then, you know, your maths revision would always smell like blackcurrant and you would need to take your blackcurrant pen into your exam. But it's just a little thing, you know, but it will boost your engagement of your brain, and then that's going to support your learning.
Yeah, and I'm always telling my students, firstly, to reflect on what have been their most successful learning experiences, because I know particularly with revision, the kind of stereotype of what a successful revision technique looks like is reading through notes with a highlighter, making flashcards and making revision notes. And that is just kind of one subset of the things that you can do. And actually what I tell students to do, you know, I tell students that there's a kind of continuum of revision techniques that range from the passive to the active. And the more active you can get with your revision and the more creative you can get with it, the more effective it's going to be. And I think you're just telling us kind of the same thing using different words.
Yes, well, I think that's an interesting one. I think what we tend to do when we focus on revision is try and remember stuff we already know. And that does lead you to writing things down and highlighter pens, mm-hmm. and stuff like that. But if you think about the stuff that you could confidently talk to somebody about, probably the things that you know the most about are things that you've done. You know, if you've got a hobby, so for example, I do a lot of swimming. I don't need to revise swimming in order to be able to talk to you about it. I know swimming because I've done it, I've lived it. I just wouldn't even cross my mind to write something down about it. Mm-hmm. So if you are just aiming to remember something, yes, you know, writing it down, repeating it to yourself, writing it down again, repeating it to yourself will probably stick it in your memory for a bit and enable you to carry it into an exam. Mm-hmm. But it would be better just to know it,
yes.
and to know it so richly that you didn't even have to think about whether you were remembering it or not, because it's just a part of you. And if you do things in a multi-sensory way, if you engage with them with that depth, that's a much quicker route to knowing them than writing them down over and over again.
Okay, so I think this is fascinating. Can you give us a specific example of something that you could learn in a multi-sensory way? You know, think about your background in teaching and what have you taught in a multi-sensory way that was particularly kind of memorable for the students and maybe for you as well?
There's lots of examples. You know, any sort of amount of science could be stripped back into the actual experiments themselves, or mm-hmm. things like that. In maths, it's very interesting that we often remove the concrete resources that we use when we teach maths as soon as the abstract notions have been acquired. And actually there's a huge benefit in leaving those resources out. It's just simple things like the cubes that we use for counting and having students manipulate them as they do more complex problems, because you get a richer understanding from that. But your question for me about what's been most successful, the first of the sensory projects was the sensory story project. And so I write and tell stories in a sensory way, and that has been amazing. It's not an idea that I came up with. It's an idea that I met in my teaching practice and was so excited by that I've gone on to set up the sensory story project. And so for an example of that, I have a story that's about how stars are formed in stellar nurseries. And it's a 7-sentence story, but it is scientifically accurate. So it tells in just 7 sentences how stars are formed in stellar nurseries. And each of the sentences has a sensory experience that goes with it that also communicates the meaning. And I would argue communicates the meaning equally to the words. So you can access the meaning of that story through the words or through the sensory experiences. And I can use that story to talk to people who are, you know, who are studying physics at A level, and I can use that story to share that information with somebody who has a profound disability and doesn't access language at all. But thinking about your students and their revision, there's some interesting stuff about how we forget and the links to that and the sensory world that could be useful. So for example, they studied 2 types of forgetting in the 50s. They studied state-dependent forgetting and context-dependent forgetting. And obviously, if you're going into exam, you don't want to forget something. So knowing how people forget things, it's useful for knowing how to remember things. Context-dependent forgetting, everybody has done. It's that moment when you walk out of the room, forget what you walked out for, come back into the room and remember what it was you were doing.
Yeah, I do that several times a day.
Exactly. As you get older, you attribute it to age and you think it's because you're aging. But if you talk to teenagers, they do it too. It's just that when we get older, we think it's because we're older.
Well, and you've got so many more things reminds to remember.
Yeah. Yes, that's it. What reminds you of what you were going out to do is the sensory information that you're getting in that room. It's what it sounds like in there, it's what it looks like in there. And once you're back in that sensory environment, you remember what it was that you went out to do, and you can set off again. And then state-dependent forgetting is the same thing, but instead of the physical context that you're in, it's the chemical state that your body is in. Okay. And that is affected by your sensory environment as well. So it's affected by the amount of light in a room. It's affected by how much sleep you've had. And it's affected by what you've eaten and drunk and any medications you may have taken.
What about your kind of emotional state? Does that affect
it? Yes, that would definitely affect your brain chemistry as well. That's a huge tangent, because the tangent is to the importance of having a calm brain. Mm-hmm. A calm brain can remember, can learn. A stressed brain cannot remember and cannot learn. And there are sensory ways that we can support people in maintaining calm. But just to tack back to the state and context-dependent forgetting, what you are looking to do is to be in the same sensory context and the same sensory state when you learn information and when you recall information. So in terms of your sitting in an exam, if you can create an environment at home to revise in that is sensorially similar to the exam hall, so it might mean not revising with music on. Music's an interesting one, because if that helps you to feel calm, then maybe you do need it. But in an ideal world, you'd sit in the exam hall in the seat that you're going to do your exam in and learn the material there, because in that same physical context, you are going to be better able to remember that information.
This is interesting. I just want to come in, because you talked earlier about that difference between kind of being able to remember something long enough to use it in an exam, and the difference between that and deep learning. And it feels a bit like what you're talking about here, like setting up the environment so that you're better able to recall that information in the exam, is more that kind of surface level learning than that kind of deep muscle memory kind of learning that we talked about before. Have I understood that correctly?
That's interesting. I mean, it definitely would support the surface stuff just as a revision technique. But also, you are more likely, those sorts of, you know, the swimming skills, I'm probably more likely to be able to explain them to you if I'm in a swimming pool, if I'm in the context that I associate those skills with. So it would go for both.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I wanted to come back and just talk a bit about the stories bit of what you were talking about, and just talk about how people could actually apply that to like remembering, for example, if you've got a whole Shakespeare play that you need to know and you need to remember the plot line, and there are probably specific quotes within that that you need to remember for an exam, how would you counsel a student to use the kind of sensory stories idea in that kind of context?
what you would probably typically do in that situation, and we're back to that sort of boring writing stuff down type of learning, is you would make yourself a set of notes about the play, and then you would make notes about your notes, and you'd have a set of bullet points that were the key points that you wanted to remember, and you would hope to be able to expand from each of those bullet points to the rest of the information associated with it. Mm-hmm. And that sort of chunking up of information to help us hold on to it is something that I think people commonly do when they're revising. The trouble is, when you walk into that exam, you've probably got goodness knows how many bullet points in your head that you're mm-hmm. trying to remember associated with different topics. Maybe there's going to be two or three questions on the paper and you've got sort of 12 bullet points for each one. And it's very difficult to remember them.
Yeah.
If you could associate those bullet points with a sensory story, because a sensory story is so novel and they're quite fun, you would remember the story. You know, my students who I do The Birth of a Star with, I repeat the seven sentences of that sensory story, and we share those seven sensory experiences on repeat for probably a whole half the term. So, you know, if you're doing that once a week in your science lessons, you'd have heard that story seven or eight times by the end of term. They know those seven sentences by heart mm-hmm. and they remember those experiences. And actually, because it's a story, it carries you through. You know, seven individual bullet points don't hold together. They roam off on their own and you can forget one and not realise. But it's a bit like singing a song. You know, once somebody starts you off on the first line, the rest of them run through. And because you've done it in a sensory way, we're back to what I was saying at the start, more of your brain is involved, you are more likely to remember it. You know, think about the times that you remember that stand out in your memory. This mm-hmm. idea that you have about being reflective of how you learn, what are the memorable occasions in your life? Were they occasions that had particular sensory qualities? You know, do you remember the event with the fireworks, or do you remember somewhere where you had a wonderful dinner? These sensory inputs that we get from the world really make things stand out to us.
Yeah, definitely. And so I just think it's useful here to bring in some of the experiences that the students I've worked with have had. And when I encouraged one year 10 pupil who I've been coaching to reflect on his most successful learning experiences and how he could use those creatively in his own revision, he realised that he worked really well with pictures and diagrams, and he was really struggling with his English. So what he did was that he created kind of picture boards for each of the texts that he needed, and also found pictures that he could associate with the quotes that he needed to learn off by heart, so that when he looked at the picture, it would stimulate the memory of the quote, and it was kind of a bridging point to help him actually get to the point where he could remember the information that he needed to have that kind of stimulus. And because his brain worked in that way where he really associated well with pictures, if he brought the picture into his mind, he could then begin to remember the words that actually went into the quote. And, you know, he came up with that himself by using his reflection abilities and being creative about how he could apply it. You know, he realised that diagrams work really well for him in physics, and so he was like, okay, but this is how I could use them in English to be able to help me with a subject that I find more challenging. So does that kind of ring true with the kind of experiences that you have?
That's a lovely visual example, and it is one that comes up in revision practices, isn't it? We talked about note-taking and highlighting. The highlighting is that beginning of the recognition that a visual stimulus can support you in engaging with the material. It might be that you're a student who's heard people saying, why don't you highlight the key points? Why don't you draw a diagram? And it doesn't really work for you, and mm-hmm. you're still none the wiser. You might be somebody who remembers things in a tactile way. You might be somebody who would remember something if you made a little dinner of it. That would be a hilarious thing to do, to create a little sort of Shakespearean dinner.
Yeah.
For myself, if I want to remember something and I'm in bed at night and I haven't got a pen handy to write it down, I will pick up an object near me and I will say whatever it is that I want to remember out loud, and then I'll lob that object across the room. And I have to say it as I lob it, because you're late at night, sometimes you don't remember, sometimes you just think, oh, I have to lob an object. If I say it as I lob the object, then when I wake up in the morning, I see whatever it is on the floor in the wrong place. And as I pick it up, I remember whatever it was that I said out loud as I threw it.
Yeah.
And so that's a a tactile connection with my memory, and it's also a physical movement connection. So on the sensory projects, I run to 7 sensory systems, so the famous 5 that you'll have heard of, and I also use your proprioceptive and vestibular system, which is your awareness of where your body is in space, mm-hmm. and your motion and balance. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that is really good for prompting memory in an auditory way is singing. Everybody knows they remember songs. So if you've got a set of key terms that you need to remember for your revision, crowbar them into a song, sing it. And once you get that first line of the song in your head in the exam, you'll remember the rest. But a movement sequence is the sort of, it's the physical version of that. So a movement sequence would be something that I would use to support people in remembering through their proprioceptive and vestibular systems. And they're beautifully effective. I would argue that they're as effective as singing. And I've done them for, I've got a lovely one for a Michael Rosen poem. And we remember the whole of that piece of poetry through the movements of this sequence. So you can have Shakespeare in movement.
Yeah, I know in my Facebook group, there's a girl, the parent of a girl who has dyslexia. And this girl, I think, does an awful lot of dance in her spare time. So actually using dance to try and help her to remember the plots of plays and that kind of thing, that, you know, when she finds it difficult to access the text, actually having that physical muscle memory could actually really help her to...
Oh, it's perfect. And I've seen people dance letters, so in practice spelling through dance.
Yeah.
Because you can write the letter shapes with your body, and then you learn the flow of how your body moves through the word, and then in remembering those movements you can write it down for tricky sort of words that you find particularly difficult to spell. Although you will sit there in the exam kind of wiggling, but
yeah, I was going to say, like, when you're sitting in an exam hall, do you kind of do it through a process of visualization of what it would be like if you were actually doing that dance at that point in time? Like, how do you do it in a kind of socially acceptable way in an exam situation?
You're allowed to wiggle a bit in the exam.
People expect it. Yeah. Yeah, that's all fascinating. I also wanted to bring in, sorry to keep going back to my stuff, but I was a geography teacher before I did this, and one of the things I loved about geography was actually field trips and going out and actually seeing the things yourself, because like a case study or whatever makes so much more sense when you actually see it, walk down the streets or climb the mountain or see the river or do the field work. And I think, you know, whatever you can do to get out there and actually see and experience what you're studying makes a huge, huge difference. And I've actually written a blog post about revising geography case studies. And one of the things I say in there is, if you can, even if the school doesn't take you on a trip, go and visit the place. And a second best is like using resources like Google Maps to get the satellite view and the street view of the place, so that you can actually almost get down to street level through the medium of digital technology and experience that place, so you can really visualize it in your head. And also the benefits of maps and seeing how different places link together, and all that kind of makes these case studies, which I remember when I was at school, I used to think, do they make some of these things up, you know, these case studies, mm-hmm. or are they actually real? They're all real, but you make them real by having some kind of direct experience of them, and that makes them a lot easier to remember.
Yes, obviously not everybody's going to be able to go on the trip, but you could make yourself, you know, a little shoebox version of it and include some natural resources. I'm just thinking the using of Google Maps is, again, it's that pulling in of the visual sense, mm-hmm. to a process that's otherwise primarily linguistic. A lot of the people that I work with have no access to language, and oftentimes they have very significant visual impairments. And we live in a society that is very language-based,
yeah.
and very visually biased. We arrange our, you know, we arrange our routes around the place according to vision. We could arrange them according to sound. You know, our roads could be mapped out with little bells that sort of tinkle and show us the way. But we use the visual sense. If that's not working for you, be that because you don't have access to it or because it's just, you know, not your style, it's really useful to pull in the other senses. So we've talked about moving through a through an experience doing dance or something like that to do the proprioceptive and vestibular ones. I've mentioned briefly that you could make up a little Shakespearean dinner.
Yeah.
Touching things, manipulating objects. The sensory system that I would look to most if I was trying to remember something is smell. And this is a tricky one because smell is the only sense that is processed by the limbic brain. So smell goes direct to your emotional and your memory centers in mm-hmm. your brain. All your other senses are processed by your thalamus, your thinking brain. So smells that associate with a memory for you are incredibly powerful. But because they're not processed by the thalamus, it's kind of less structured. If you think about your other senses, you know, sight, we have the colours. We can order the colours. I can talk about primary colours and secondary colours to you. Mm-hmm. And you have a kind of language that you can share that information with me. We don't have that language for smell. I can't tell you what your primary smells are. And we have a very personal reaction to smell. But going on the geography field trip, you will smell that yeah. environment. And that having had that just the smell of the place around you will anchor that experience in your memory so much more than looking around it on Google Maps. And so maybe just making up, I can't think what your geography field trips would be, trips to rocky outcrops, trips yeah. to see
or
Spone
even
lakes.
Urban areas, yeah, all sorts yeah. of different so, places.
I make up little worlds in shoeboxes quite often. So you get an open box and you make just a little miniature landscape. Doing something like that, even though it's not the smell of the actual place, there will be a smell associated with it as you manipulate the earth or as you sort of stack up the little bits of concrete. And those smells will log in your memory and make you remember what you were doing. And hopefully that's something that you could draw to mind in yeah. the exam.
Yeah, unfortunately, you can't do a field trip to every single case study that you study. But, you know, the ones that you can access, then, you know, it's an amazing thing to be able to do to really bring that thing to life.
Even just having an object, you know, yeah. having an item from the environment so that there's something there to see, to touch, to smell would add to the teaching and hopefully to studying.
Yeah, it's like I was given by one of the people I was at university with, she had a holiday home on the island of Montserrat, and she gave me a piece of the lava from the eruption of the volcano there, and I've still got it, and I used to take it into school when I was teaching about volcanoes, and actually just being able to feel that piece of rock and what it's like and how light it is and all that kind of thing, that can give so much more meaning to what you're talking about than just describing it with words.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah, it's amazing. Okay, so it's going to be mainly parents listening to this. So what practical steps can parents take to help their children learn and revise at home more effectively using their senses?
I think the biggest one for parents who are looking to support their children in their revision is to be managing their stress levels. Because like we said earlier, a stressed brain can't learn. A stressed brain can't remember. And how you manage stress in a sensory way is really interesting. So on one of the conferences that I run, one of the courses that I run, I do an event called Develop Your Sensory Lexiconry. And the lexiconry takes the delegates through 7 sensory systems. And we look at the development of each of those sensory systems. And we tend to think of our senses as either being there or not being there. Either you've got eyes and you can see or you haven't. Mm-hmm. But actually, we acquire our senses in the way that we acquire any kind of skill. So when we learn maths, if I were to put all the maths I know on a board and show it to you and go, there's maths, learn it, you would really struggle. Yeah. You'd probably give up and think, this is not for me. If I give you experiences of one and many, and then I teach you to count, and then I teach you to add, and then I teach you subtraction and multiplication, if I build you up in those steps, you're much more likely to end up in a position where you can access all the maths on the board. Mm-hmm. And our senses are the same. There are things that we can do first. So there's the sensory equivalent of the one and many and the learning to count. And then it steps up through. We kind of know it with babies because we recognize that babies see a kind of blurry version of the world and they see in black and white lots of early little tiny picture books for very small babies are in bold black and white colours, because that's early on in the development of sight. But the interesting thing about these early sensory experiences is the ones that we experience first, the ones that our brain is first able to process, are also often the ones that we find calming. And creating a sensory environment that is rich with these early developmental sensory experiences is a calming environment, and a calming environment is going to be better for people to learn in. And so it's simple things like, so for the development of sight, you're looking for warm tones, you're not looking for too much bold stimulus, you just sort of kind of pinky redness would be ideal.
A bit like how a spa is decorated, those kind of
colours. Yes, yes, I bet they've just happened upon that by accident. But yes, I should have a spa. I get all sorts of people on the lexicon read. Last year I had somebody from a circus attend.
Oh, wow.
You know,
oh, wow.
People take from it very different things depending on what they do. But for sound, you don't want lots of spiky, loud sounds around. You want a gentle kind of background hum. For taste, and you will be wanting to feed your children, there's an excuse to give them sweet things. So sort of a sweet milk drink is a very, you know, if you think about those sweet milky drinks, you think of them as being comforting because they are very soothing types of things. Smells, you'd be looking, well, it's a bit tricky because of that connection with smell and memory. So we could create a smell environment that's very reassuring, or we could be creating a smell environment that links to particular topics. And you don't want to overwhelm people with smells because it's such an emotional sense. Mm-hmm. So it might be that you have a nice soothing scented candle, you know, a chamomile or a lavender candle running for them, and that just keeps them all calm whilst they're revising. Or it might be that you're not going to do too many smells so that they can engage with whatever smell they've associated with that topic. What other senses have I got left? Sight, sound, touch, tactile stuff. It is really good to have something, you want quite a strong tactile sensation, because if you know where your body is, mm-hmm. you feel safe. So it's things like when somebody hugs you, that gives you a lot of information about where your body is in space, and that sort of squeezing, compressive feeling makes you feel calm and secure. Whereas if somebody were to sort of gently stroke you, that's a bit ticklish or a bit annoying. Mm-hmm. That's not nice. So somewhere you can feel really kind of safe and secure. And actually often little spaces are good for that. You know, when we're worried, when we feel anxious, because we are an animal essentially, we go for little hiding spaces. You know, people who are struggling will curl up on a ball on the sofa, yeah. or will get into bed and hide under the covers. So actually that kind of cocoon sensation, having this little space where you are safe and where there's nice sweet milk to drink and everything's going to be fine, is good for supporting a
brain.
It's
almost like going back to infancy, isn't it? It's,
yeah,
you know what you're describing, it's almost like the fetal position, soft, you know,
encasing
blankets, cushions, and yeah. you know, even the milk, that's like going yeah. back to infancy. And you know, I know when I want to feel comfort and secure, things like milky drinks and kind of hunkering down with a blanket and some cushions on the sofa, all that makes me feel better. And so it just kind of makes sense, that idea of going back to infancy and what makes an infant feel better when they're distressed.
Yeah, it's absolutely that. So it's creating a calm sensory environment. And obviously you're not adding to the stress that they, if your child is already revising, you don't need to be saying, have you done your revision? Have you done? Because your stress will pass on to them.
Yes.
And a stressed brain can't learn.
And I think that's what many of the parents that I talk to struggle with, is they hold all this anxiety about their children, and even if they see their children are revising, they're worried that they're not doing enough, or they're not doing it in the right way, or they're not doing enough past papers. Yeah. And they want to ask the questions, but the questions then trigger the teenagers, and it all ends up being a bit difficult. And it's probably a conversation for another day, but it's very difficult for the parents to keep their own stress contained.
It's your reflective message. So maybe they need, if they've got a teenager who is revising, and parents who have that level of anxiety are very likely to have produced a child who's already doing all that worrying for themselves. Mm-hmm. Not not necessarily that that's been an inheritance of anxiety, but that anxiety is an extension of a conscientiousness that they will have doubtlessly already taught their child. So what they need to do is consider what their role is in the exam process. Is their role to be monitoring and to be checking, or has that child got that covered? Is their role to be creating an environment where learning can happen, mm-hmm. and to be creating that calm space and to be the steadying presence? You spoke about going back to early childhood. What we want in early childhood is to be very near mummy and daddy, and yes. for mummy and daddy to be okay and to be happy. And so if you've set them up with a little revision space and they can hear you in the background and you sound calm and you sound relaxed and you've got your own milky drink, you know, and you're on the sofa, then that's a lovely environment for learning in.
Yeah, and that's all stuff. I put together something for the parents this exam season called the Supportive Parents Exam Season Toolkit. And I really emphasise things like how they could support their children's nutrition by having the right kind of food to support their body and health and their emotional support and all that kind of thing, rather than focusing on the actual revision. All these kind of the role of the carer really in supporting them. And I think if parents kind of reevaluate their role, and I think this is really only possible when they aren't having to stress too much about what revision is actually happening, but if they can allow themselves into that role of a carer and emotional support, and that sheer presence, that's something I've talked about several times over the last few weeks, is just being present, because that presence just gives so much more support. And I think it's difficult often in this society where everybody seems to work and is out of the home and things, but you know, as much as you can, being present, just it's a physical sign of that emotional support.
Yeah. Well, one of the smells that we find most comforting, so we have two types of smell receptors. We've got ones that register the volatile sense, and so far all the smells that I've mentioned have been volatile sense, and we have ones that register pheromone sense.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't generally think of ourselves as going around sniffing pheromones, but actually we are still animals and our lives are hugely dictated by pheromone sense. If the classic example is when you meet somebody who you can see is really physically attractive, but you just don't fancy them.
Yeah.
That will be because their pheromone scent doesn't match up to what you desire.
Mm-hmm.
So we still choose our partners based on the way they smell. You know, we're like dogs sniffing each other's bottoms. That is still a part of how we interact with each other. And the pheromone sense of your nearest and dearest, the pheromone sense of your mummy and daddy, will be enormously comforting to you always.
Mm-hmm.
And so for parents who aren't able to be present, things like the pillow that they sleep on at night will have your the places in your body that produce pheromones, places on your neck and the top of your head produce pheromones. So a parent's pillow will smell, it's not a pongy smell, it's, you don't want something that stinks. You don't smell pheromones in the same way that you smell volatile scents, but that pheromone scent will be there on their pillow.
Mm.
And you could have that in the, so when you're setting up their little revision environment with this little den that we're talking about, just take the pillow off your bed and put it in there, because yeah. that smell is very, very calming to people.
Well, that's lovely. That's a really lovely thought, and yeah, just a nice place to leave that part of the discussion. So just moving on, can you tell us a bit more about your books and what problems they could solve for the parents that are listening?
About my books?
Yes, yeah.
Right. So the sensory storybook is about how we create and use sensory stories. It is a practitioner manual aimed at people who are supporting children with special needs and disabilities, and it's appropriate if you're supporting adults with those conditions as well. It's interesting in the first section of that book I talk about the importance of sensory stimulus, and that covers some of the things that we've talked about today but in more detail. So it covers the impact of sensory stimulation on memory and on learning and on engagement and things like this. And although it is aimed at that a market of people who won't be sitting exams, if you are curious about this sort of thing, if you're interested, it does have application. Borrow it from a library.
Yeah.
Sensory Being for Sensory Beings talks about how we facilitate the benefits of mindfulness practice in a sensory way.
Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting for me because a lot of the people that I work with don't have a concept of time. They exist in the moment. And for us, if we were to practice mindfulness, which is a wonderful calming thing to do and would be very good as a little revision.
Yeah, I've got a blog post all about meditation for students.
For us, that is a process of gently herding our attention back to the present and saying, think about the now. But for somebody who exists in the present, they are already mindful in that definition. And so I needed to find a way of holding them in that present moment in the way that we are held in the present moment by mindfulness. And I've called the method that we came up with Sensory Being. But in that book, a huge chunk of that book is the development of each of the 7 sensory systems that I run to on the projects. And so all of what we have been discussing about creating a calming, nurturing environment, all that information about early sensory development is right there. And we're talking about, I'm saying, you know, I work for children who have special needs and you're talking about mainstream children who mm-hmm. are going to sit exams. Actually, it's not that black and white, is it? Within mainstream, there'll be all sorts of additional needs. And it's things like, you know, children with attachment disorders, because those early developmental experiences are linked to early social relationships and bonding. Those are hugely beneficial experiences to be offering to children like that. Children who've experienced disrupted lives, you know, children who've been in care, children who've had to just even just kind of low level disruption, like moving house or moving schools a lot of time.
Or divorced children parents are heavy. Or
divorced, yeah. These things, I said low level, but actually to a child, these are huge. Yeah. And so those early developmental sensory experiences, again, it's really useful to know about them. And it can help you make sense of why some things bother a child and other things don't. So for a lot of people that I support with autism, some of the early developmental sensory experiences will either be the ones that they find really calming or the ones that they find really distressing mm-hmm. because their brain processes them so much more effectively. So if you're somebody who's bothered by visual stimulus and your brain processes a certain branch of visual stimulus better, that's going to be the, you know, the brightest, the boldest, the most distressing. So having that understanding of sensory development is useful to a lot of people. And the book Sensory Being for Sensory Beings, which comes out, should be on 6th of September, I think, has information about that in. And then the 3rd practitioner manual that is due out for publication next year is a book around sensory stories and conversations for people with dementia. So hopefully that's not any of your students who are studying for their exams right
now. No, but it might be interesting for families anyway if they want to check it out. Well, thank you so much for all of that. It's been absolutely, you know, a fascinating conversation, and I think there's so much overlap in what we talk about, and I think it's so interesting how often I think in schools we do see special needs as being a bit separate to the mainstream, but they're not. It is a continuum. And learning, you know, all the things that you've been talking about and applying them to the learning of mainstream children is so important and something for us all to think about in more detail.
Probably more useful to people than the books would be my website, where there's lots of free resources and free information and free downloads. So if people want to find out more about sensory engagement and how it might support their students, I would recommend. I mean, do buy the books, of course, but my website is probably a better link.
Okay, well, then that's exactly what I was leading on to. So what is your website?
It's a tricky one to remember because it's not a www. It's http :// and then the web address is jo.element42
Okay, and I will link to that in the show notes. So that people can easily find that. And what about social media? Where can people find you on social media?
I tweet excerpts from research to do with sensory stuff at twice a day, and also have all sorts of Twitter conversations, and I tweet from @Jo3Grace, and I'm on Facebook as a person, not as a page or a business. I am just a person, so I'm Joanna Grace on Facebook, and my profile picture is the blue star from The Birth of a Star story that I talked about earlier.
lovely. And well, that's brilliant. Thank you, Jo, so much for that. And so if parents are interested in finding out more about this, it sounds like the most logical place to go is to start with your website and then progress onto the books if that's where they want to go with it, with this.
Yeah.
So thank you so much for sparing the time to talk to us today. It's been a really marvellous discussion. I've learned a lot, and I know that the people listening will have learned a huge amount as well. So thank you so much.
I absolutely loved that discussion. I thought it was so interesting, and Jo had so many useful nuggets to share with us. So if you want to know more about the things that Jo and I talked about today and go into it in a bit more detail, head over to the show notes at lifemoreextraordinary.com/15 to find out how you can get in touch with Jo and access her website and her books. I really think the things that we've learned today are really worth taking forward and bearing in mind when you're supporting your child with their revision, because so much revision kind of excludes so many of the senses, the kind of things that we traditionally believe we should be doing when we're revising, like highlighting and taking notes and using flashcards. And the more we can incorporate other senses into the learning experience, the more profound and long-lasting the learning is going to be, and the more pleasurable and interesting it's going to be. Okay, all it remains for me to say is if you'd like to get in touch with me, pass any comments on or ask any questions or even suggest a topic for us to cover on the podcast, I'd love you to get in touch with me. You can do that by emailing me at lucy@lifemoreextraordinary.com. That's lucy@lifemoreextraordinary.com. Or you can join the Parents Only Facebook group, which is the Supportive Parents Successful Students Facebook group, and you'll find a link to that in the show notes. And also you could tweet me if Twitter's your thing, and you'll find me at Lucy C. Parsons. If you're enjoying the show and you think it's giving you a lot of value, I'd really appreciate you leaving a review, letting me know what you think about the show, and also it will help others to find the show so that they can get some use and help from the things that I'm sharing. Thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day and goodbye.